Lysander, when Dionysius the tyrant sent expensive garments for his daughters, would not accept them, saying he feared they would appear the more shameful on their account. To those who reproached him for accomplishing most things by deceit, as unworthy of Heracles, he used to say that where the lion's skin does not reach, the fox's skin must be sewn on. When the Argives seemed to speak more justly than the Lacedaemonians about the disputed territory, he drew his sword and said, "Whoever holds this argues best about the boundaries of land." And when he saw the Lacedaemonians reluctant to press the attack on the walls of the Corinthians, on seeing a hare leap out of the ditch, he said, "Are these the sort of enemies you fear, whose hares sleep undisturbed within their walls out of sheer idleness?" And when a man of Megara spoke to him with frankness in a public gathering, he said, "Your words need a city behind them." Agesilaus used to say that those who dwell in Asia were bad as free men but good as slaves. Since they were accustomed to call the king of the Persians great, he said, "How is he greater than I unless he is also more just and more temperate?" When asked, concerning courage and justice, which was the better, he said, "We have no need of courage at all if all of us are just." When one night, as he was about to withdraw in haste from enemy territory, he saw his beloved being left behind through weakness, weeping, he said, "It is hard to feel both pity and sound judgment at once." When Menecrates the physician, who was called Zeus, wrote him a letter that began, "Menecrates Zeus to King Agesilaus, greetings," he wrote back, "King Agesilaus to Menecrates, good health." When the Lacedaemonians defeated the Athenians and their allies at Corinth, and he learned the number of the enemy dead, he said, "Alas for Greece, which has destroyed by her own hand so many men as would have sufficed to conquer all the barbarians." Having received at Olympia from Zeus the oracle he wished, and then, when the ephors bade him ask the Pythian god about the same matters, he went to Delphi and asked the god whether he too approved what his father approved. When he was begging off some favor for one of his friends from Idrius the Carian, he wrote to him, "If Nicias is not guilty, release him. If he is guilty, release him for my sake. In any case, release him." When someone who imitated the voice of the nightingale invited him to listen to it, he said, "I have often heard the bird itself." After the battle at Leuctra, since the law required that all who had fled be disenfranchised, the ephors, seeing the city bereft of men, wished to suspend the disenfranchisement, and they appointed Agesilaus lawgiver. And he, coming forward into their midst, ordered that the laws should take effect from the next day onward. When, having been sent as an ally to the king of the Egyptians, he was being besieged along with him, the enemy being many times more numerous, and digging a trench around the camp. And the king urged him to sally out and fight it out. He said he would not prevent the enemy from making themselves equal to his own numbers if they wished. But when only a small gap remained for the ditch to close, he drew up his forces at that point where it was still open, and fighting against equal numbers, equal to equal, he won. As he was dying, he ordered his friends to make no image of him, molded or modeled, saying, "If I have done any noble deed, that is my monument. But if I have done none, not even all the statues in the world will help." Archidamus, son of Agesilaus, on seeing a catapult bolt, then brought for the first time from Sicily, cried out, "O Heracles, the valor of man is done for." And the younger Agis, when Demaed said that Laconian swords were so short that jugglers could swallow them, said, "And yet it is the Lacedaemonians above all who reach the enemy with their swords." When the ephors ordered him to hand over soldiers to the traitor, he said he did not trust foreigners to a man who had betrayed his own people. Cleomenes, to a man who promised to give him fighting cocks that would die in battle, said, "Not those, rather give me the ones that kill in battle." Pederetus, not having been chosen among the 300, which was the foremost honor in the city in rank, went away cheerful and smiling, saying he was glad that the city had 300 citizens better than himself. Damonidas, having been assigned to the last place in the chorus by the man arranging it, said, "Well done, you have discovered how this place too may become honored." Nicostratus, the general of the Argives, when urged by Archidamus to betray a certain place for a great sum of money and marriage to a Laconian woman of his choosing, apart from the royal family, replied that Archidamus was no descendant of Heracles, for Heracles went about punishing the wicked, but Archidamus made the good wicked. Eudemidas, seeing in the academy Xenocrates, already an old man, philosophizing with his pupils, and learning that he was in search of virtue, said, Then when will he make use of it? Again, on hearing a philosopher argue that only the wise man is a good general, he said, "The argument is admirable, but the speaker has not sounded the trumpet." Antiochus, while Ephor, on hearing that Philip had given the Messenians their land, asked whether he had also given them the power to hold it by fighting for it. Antalcidas, to the Athenian who called the Lacedaemonians ignorant, said, "At any rate, we alone have learned no evil from you." And when another Athenian said to him, "But we have often driven you back from the Cephisus," he said, "But we have never driven you back from the Eurotas." When a sophist was about to read a eulogy of Heracles, he said, "Who, then, finds fault with him?" While Epaminondas the Theban was general, no panic ever fell upon the camp. He used to say that death in war was the noblest death, and he declared that the bodies of hoplites ought to be trained not only athletically, but also for military service. For this reason, he made war on the corpulent, and he drove one such man out of the army, saying that 3 or 4 shields could scarcely cover his belly, on account of which he had not seen his own genitals. So frugal was he in his way of living that, having been invited to dinner by a neighbor, on finding a display of cakes and delicacies and perfumes, he left at once, saying, "I thought you were making a sacrifice, not committing an outrage." When the cook was rendering an account to his fellow officials of the expense of several days, he was vexed only at the quantity of oil. And when his colleagues wondered at this, he said it was not the expense that troubled him, but whether so much oil had been taken into his body. When the city was celebrating a festival and everyone was engaged in drinking and revelry, he met one of his acquaintances, unkempt and walking with a troubled look. And when the man wondered and asked why he alone went about in such a state, he said, "So that it may be possible for all of you to get drunk and take your ease." When a worthless man had committed some minor offense, though Pelopidas pleaded for him, he would not release him. But when the man's mistress begged for him, he released him, saying that such favors were fit to be granted to courtesans, but not to generals. And when, as the Lacedaemonians were making war, oracles were being brought to the Thebans, some foretelling defeat and others victory, he ordered those who brought them to place the ones on the right side of the platform and the others on the left. When all had been placed, he stood up and said, "If you are willing to obey your commanders and go to meet the enemy, these are the oracles for you," pointing to the better ones. "But if you lose heart before the danger, then those are," looking toward the worse ones. Again, as he was advancing upon the enemy, there was a clap of thunder, and when those around him asked what he thought the god meant by it, he said the enemy had been thunderstruck, because, with such ground nearby, they are encamping in such a place as this. He said that of all the fine and good things that had happened to him, the most pleasant was that his father and mother were still living when he conquered the Lacedaemonians at Leuctra. Though he was accustomed to appear at other times anointed in body and cheerful in countenance, on the day after that battle, he came forward unkempt and downcast. And when his friends asked whether some misfortune had befallen him, he said, "Nothing, but yesterday I perceived that I had felt a greater pride than is proper, and so today I am chastening the excess of my joy." Knowing that the Spartans concealed such misfortunes, and wishing to expose the magnitude of their disaster, he did not grant them all together the recovery of their dead, but to each city separately, so that the Lacedaemonian dead, being more than 1,000, were seen to be so many. When Jason, the monarch of the Thessalians, came to Thebes as an ally, and sent Epaminondas, who was in dire poverty, 2,000 pieces of gold, he did not accept the gold. But on seeing Jason, he said, "You are exercising an unjust power." He himself, having borrowed 50 drachmas from one of the citizens as travel money for the campaign, invaded the Peloponnese. Again, when the king of the Persians sent him 30,000 darics, he bitterly rebuked Diomedon for having sailed so long a voyage to corrupt Epaminondas. And he bade him tell the king that if he had in mind what was advantageous to the Thebans, he would have Epaminondas as a friend for nothing, but if not, as an enemy. When the Argives became allies of the Thebans, and Athenian envoys, arriving in Arcadia, accused both peoples, and Callistratus the orator reproached the two cities with Orestes and Oedipus, Epaminondas rose up and said, "We admit that among us a father-slayer was born, and among the Argives a mother slayer. But those who did these deeds we cast out, while the Athenians received them. And to the Spartans, who had leveled many grave charges against the Thebans, he said, "It was these men, at any rate, who cured you of speaking so briefly." When Alexander, tyrant of Pherae, an enemy of the Thebans, was made a friend and ally by the Athenians, having promised to supply them meat by the pound at half an obol, Epaminondas said, "We for our part will supply the Athenians with firewood for free for that meat, for we shall cut down their land, if they meddle in affairs not their own." Wishing always to keep the Boeotians, who grew slack through idleness, under arms, whenever he was chosen Boeotarch, he would say by way of exhortation, "Consider well, men, for if I am your general, you will have to go on campaign." And he called their country, being flat and open, the dancing floor of war, since they could not hold it unless they kept their hand through the shield strap. When Chabrias, near Corinth, cut down a few Thebans who loved to fight beneath the walls and set up a trophy, Epaminondas mocked him, saying, "There ought to stand there not a trophy, but a shrine of Hecate." For it was customary to set up shrines of Hecate at the crossroads before the gates. And when someone reported that the Athenians had sent to the Peloponnese an army equipped with new arms, he said, "Why, then, does Antigenides groan because Tells has new pipes?" Tells being a very poor flute player, and Antigenides a very fine one. And on perceiving that his shield-bearer had taken a great sum of money from a man who had become a prisoner of war, he said, "Give me back my shield, and buy yourself a tavern to live out your life in, for you will no longer wish to run the same risks now that you have become one of the rich and fortunate." When asked whether he considered himself a better general than Chabrias or Iphicrates, he said, "That is hard to judge while we are still alive." When, on returning from Laconia, he was tried for his life along with his fellow generals, for having held the office of Boeotarch 4 months beyond what the law allowed, he bade his colleagues lay the blame on him, as having been forced into it, while he himself said he had no better words than his deeds. But if he must say anything at all to the judges, he asked, if they condemned him to death, that they inscribe on the pillar recording his sentence, so that the Greeks might know that Epaminondas had compelled the Thebans, against their will, to burn Laconia, which had gone unravaged for 500 years, to resettle Messene after 230 years, to organize and bring together the Arcadians into one body, and to restore to the Greeks their independence, for these were the deeds accomplished on that campaign. So the judges went out amid much laughter, without even taking up the ballots against him. In the last battle, having been wounded and carried to his tent, he called for Daphantus, and then, after him, for Iolaides. And on learning that these men were dead, he ordered that terms be made with the enemy, since they had no general left. And his deed bore out his word, as one who knew the citizens best of all. Pelopidas, the fellow general of Epaminondas, when his friends said he was neglecting a necessary matter, the gathering of money, said, "Necessary indeed is money, by Zeus, for this man," pointing to Nicodemus, a lame and crippled man. And when his wife, as he was setting out for battle, begged him to save himself, he said that this was advice to give to others, but that a ruler and general must save his fellow citizens. And when one of the soldiers said, "We have fallen into the enemy's hands," he replied, "How is that different from their falling into ours?" When he had been treacherously seized by Alexander, tyrant of Pherae, and was speaking harshly to him despite being in chains, and Alexander said, "Are you in a hurry to die?" he answered, "Certainly, so that the Thebans will be roused all the more, and you will pay the penalty sooner." When Tebe, the tyrant's wife, came to Pelopidas, and said she was amazed that he was so cheerful even in chains, he said he was amazed at her even more, that she endured Alexander without being in chains. When Epaminondas ransomed him, he said he was grateful to Alexander, for he had now tested himself most fully, and found himself of good courage not only toward war, but also toward death. Manius Curius, when some accused him of distributing only a small portion of the captured land to each man, and making the greater part public property, prayed that no Roman would ever consider the land that feeds him too little. When the Samnites came to him after their defeat and offered gold, he happened to be boiling turnips in earthen pots, and he answered the Samnites that he had no need of gold while dining on such a meal. It was better for him to rule those who possessed gold than to possess it himself. Gaius Fabricius, on learning of the Roman defeat under Levinus, said, "It was Pyrrhus, not the Epirotes, who defeated the Romans." When he went to Pyrrhus to negotiate the release of prisoners, and Pyrrhus offered him much gold, he refused to take it. The next day, Pyrrhus had his largest elephant positioned behind Fabricius, who did not know it was there, and had it let out a cry to make it suddenly appear. And when this happened, Fabricius turned around, smiled, and said, "Neither your gold yesterday nor your beast today has frightened me." When Pyrrhus urged him to stay with him and hold the second command after himself, he said, "That would not even be to your advantage, for if the Epirotes come to know us both, they will prefer to be ruled by me rather than by you." While Fabricius was consul, Pyrrhus's physician sent him a letter, offering, if he ordered it, to kill Pyrrhus with poison. Fabricius sent the letter on to Pyrrhus, urging him to realize that he was a poor judge both of friends and of enemies. When Pyrrhus discovered the plot, he had the physician hanged and returned the prisoners to Fabricius without ransom. But Fabricius did not accept them as a gift, and instead gave back an equal number in return, so that he might not seem to be taking a reward, for he had not disclosed the plot as a favor to Pyrrhus, but so that the Romans would not seem to kill by treachery, as if unable to win openly. Fabius Maximus, unwilling to fight Hannibal but preferring to wear down his forces over time, forces that were short of both money and provisions, kept following him through rough and mountainous country, marching alongside him at a distance. When the crowd mocked him and called him Hannibal's tutor, he paid little heed and followed his own reasoning, telling his friends that he considered a man who feared taunts and abuse more cowardly than one who fled from the enemy. When his co-commander Minucius struck down some of the enemy, and there was much talk of him as a man worthy of Rome, Fabius said he feared Minucius's good fortune more than his bad fortune. And shortly afterward, when Minucius fell into an ambush and was in danger of perishing with his entire force, Fabius came to his aid, destroyed many of the enemy, and saved him. Hannibal then said to his friends, "Did I not often tell you about that cloud coming down from the mountains, that it would one day break in a storm upon us?" After the disaster at Cana, when Fabius was made commander of the city together with Claudius Marcellus, a man of daring who always loved to fight Hannibal, Fabius hoped that if no one engaged him, Hannibal's forces, being stretched thin, would soon give out. So Hannibal said that he feared Fabius, who did not fight more than Marcellus, who did. When a certain Lucanian soldier was accused before him of repeatedly slipping away from camp at night out of love for a woman, though otherwise reported to be an admirable man in arms, he ordered the man's beloved to be secretly seized and brought to him. When the man was brought before him, Fabius summoned him and said, "You have not escaped notice, wandering about at night against the law, but neither had your merit escaped notice before. Let your faults be cancelled out by your good deeds, and from now on you shall remain with us, for I have a surety for you." And bringing the woman forward, he presented her to him. When Fabius, holding the Tarentines under blockade except for the Acropolis, drew Hannibal far away by a ruse and captured and plundered the city, and his secretary asked what he had decided about the sacred statues, he replied, "Let us leave the Tarentines their angry gods." When Marcus Livius, who had held the Acropolis, said that it was because of him that the city had been recovered, the others laughed, but Fabius said, "You speak the truth, for if you had not lost the city, I would never have retaken it." By now an old man, when his son was consul and was conducting public business in the presence of a large crowd, Fabius rode up on horseback toward him. The young man sent a lictor and ordered him to dismount. The others present were taken aback, but Fabius himself leapt down from his horse and, running toward his son with a speed beyond his years, embraced him and said, "Well done, my son, for understanding whom you rule and what greatness of office you have taken up." Scipio the elder, spending his leisure away from campaigns and public life in literary pursuits, used to say that when he was at leisure, he accomplished more. When he had taken Carthage by storm and some soldiers, having captured a beautiful young woman, brought her to him as a gift, he said, "I would gladly have accepted her if I were a private citizen and not a commander." While besieging the city of Bathia, above which a temple of Aphrodite could be seen, he ordered that legal pledges be sworn there, saying that on the third day he would hear the disputants in the temple of Aphrodite. And this he did, just as he had foretold, once the city had been captured. When someone in Sicily asked him what he was relying on when he intended to cross with his fleet against Carthage, He pointed to 300 armed men training and a high tower overlooking the sea, and said, "There is not one of these men who, if I ordered it, would not climb that tower and throw himself down headfirst." When he had crossed over and gained control of the land and burned the enemy's camps, the Carthaginians sent envoys and made a treaty, agreeing to give up their war elephants, their ships, and their money. But when Hannibal sailed back from Italy, they began to regret the agreement, emboldened by his return. When Scipio learned of this, he said that even if they now wished it, he would no longer keep the treaty with them unless they paid an additional 5,000 talents, because they had sent for Hannibal. When the Carthaginians, decisively defeated, sent envoys to him concerning a truce and peace, he ordered those who had come to leave at once, saying he would not hear them until they brought Lucius Terentius to him. Terentius was a Roman, a decent man, who had been taken prisoner by the Carthaginians. When they came bringing the man, Scipio seated him beside himself on the tribunal in the council, and in this way he dealt with the Carthaginians and brought the war to an end. Terentius followed him in his triumph wearing the cap of a freedman, and when Scipio died, Terentius provided honeyed wine to those who came to the funeral and showed every mark of devotion in the burial arrangements. But these things belong to a later time. When King Antiochus, after the Romans had crossed over into Asia against him, sent envoys to Scipio about a settlement, Scipio said, "You should have done this earlier, not now, when you have already accepted both the bridle and the rider." When the Senate voted that he should receive money from the treasury, and the treasurers were unwilling to open it that day, he said he would open it himself. For it was on his account that the treasury was closed, since he had filled it with so much money. When Petilius and Quintus brought many accusations against him before the people, he said that on that very day he had defeated the Carthaginians and Hannibal, and that he himself would go up, crowned, to the capital to offer sacrifice, and told anyone who wished to cast a vote against him to do so. And having said this, he began to go up, and the people followed him, leaving his accusers behind still speaking. Titus Quinctius was so distinguished from the very outset that he was elected consul before holding the offices of tribune, praetor, or aedile. Sent as general against Philip, he was persuaded to meet him for a conference. And when Philip demanded that he take hostages, on the ground that Philip himself was with many Romans while he was alone among Macedonians, Quinctius replied, "It was you yourself who made yourself alone, by killing your friends and kinsmen." Having defeated Philip in battle, he proclaimed at the Isthmian Games that he set the Greeks free and released them to their own laws. As for those Romans who had been taken captive and enslaved among the Greeks in the time of Hannibal, the Greeks ransomed each of them for 500 drachmas and gave them to him as a gift. And they too followed him in his triumph at Rome, wearing caps upon their heads, just as is the custom for those who have been freed. He ordered the Achaeans, who were planning a campaign against the island of Zacynthus, to be on their guard, lest, like tortoises stretching their heads out beyond the Peloponnese, they put themselves in danger. When King Antiochus came into Greece with a great force, and everyone was terrified at the size of his multitudes and his armaments, Quinctius made a speech of this kind to the Achaeans. He said that once, dining in Chalcis at the house of a foreign friend, he had marveled at the quantity of meat, and his host told him that all of it was actually pork, differing only in seasoning and preparation. "So do not you either," he said. "Marvel at the king's forces when you hear of lancers and cataphracts and foot companions and mounted archers. They are all Syrians, differing from one another only in their equipment." To Philopoemen, the Achaean general, who had many cavalry and infantry but was short of money, he joked that Philopoemen has hands and legs, but no belly, for in fact Philopoemen was built that way in body as well. Gnaeus Domitius, whom Scipio the Great placed in his own stead under his brother Lucius in the war against Antiochus, having reconnoitered the enemy's phalanx, and though the officers around him urged him to attack at once, said that the hour was too late to allow them, after cutting down so many tens of thousands and plundering their baggage, to return to their own camp and attend to their needs. He would do the same the next day at the proper hour. And engaging the enemy the following day, he killed 50,000 of them. Publius Licinius, consul and general, defeated by Perseus, king of the Macedonians, in a cavalry battle, lost 2,800 men, some killed, others taken prisoner. When after the battle, Perseus sent envoys concerning a truce and peace, the defeated commander ordered that the victor should leave matters concerning himself to the Romans. Paulus Aemilius, standing for a second consulship, had failed to win it. But when the war against Perseus and the Macedonians dragged on because of the inexperience and softness of the generals, they appointed him consul, and he said he was not grateful to them for it. For he had not sought office as one desiring to rule over them, but had been chosen general as one who was to rule them. Coming home from the forum and finding his little daughter Tertia in tears, he asked the reason. She said that Perseus had died, meaning a little dog by that name, and he said, "By good fortune, my daughter, and I accept the omen." Finding in the camp a great deal of insolence and idle talk among those who were meddling and giving unwanted advice, as if they were generals themselves, he ordered them to keep quiet and do nothing but sharpen their swords, and that he would see to everything else. He ordered the night watches to be kept without spear or sword, so that, despairing of being able to defend themselves against the enemy, they would fight all the harder against sleep. Marching through the highlands into Macedonia and seeing the enemy drawn up in battle order, when Nasica urged him to attack at once, he said, "If I had your youth, but my many experiences forbid me to fight against a phalanx drawn up in order, straight from the march." Having defeated Perseus and holding victory feasts, he said that it took the same skill to make an army most fearsome to enemies and a banquet most pleasant to friends. When Perseus, now a prisoner, tried to avoid being led in the triumph, Paulus said, "That is up to you," giving him the choice of taking his own life. Though immense wealth was found, he took none of it himself, but gave his son-in-law to bear a silver bowl weighing 5 pounds as a prize for valor. And this, they say, was the first silver vessel to enter the household of the Aelii. He had had 4 sons, 2 of them had earlier been given up in adoption to other families. Of the 2 remaining in his own household, 1 died 5 days before the triumph, at the age of 14, and the other died 5 days after the triumph, at the age of 12. Coming forward while the people grieved and shared in his sorrow, he said that now he had no fear or danger to feel for his country, since fortune, inventing her retribution for his successes upon his own household, had made him alone bear it on behalf of all. Cato the Elder, attacking extravagance and luxury before the people, said, "How hard it is to speak to a belly that has no ears." He said he marveled how a city could survive in which a fish sold for more than an ox. Once denouncing the growing dominance of women, he said, "All men rule their wives, we rule all men, and our wives rule us." He said he would rather do a good deed and receive no thanks for it than commit a wrong and escape punishment for it, and that he was always ready to grant pardon to all who erred, except himself. Urging magistrates to reprimand wrongdoers, he said that those who have the power to stop wrongdoers, if they fail to stop them, are in effect commanding them to do wrong. He said that of the young he preferred those who blushed to those who turned pale. He said he despised a soldier who, while marching, moved his hands, but while fighting, moved his feet, and who snored louder than he shouted in battle. He used to say that the worst kind of ruler is one who cannot rule himself. He held that above all each man ought to feel reverence before himself, for no one is ever without himself. Seeing many statues being set up for people, he said, "I would rather have men ask why there is no statue of Cato than why there is one." He urged those in power to be sparing in the use of their authority, so that the power to act would always remain with them. He said that those who take away the honor due to virtue take away virtue itself from the young, and he said that a ruler or judge ought neither to be entreated on behalf of just causes nor to be pressed into abandoning them on behalf of unjust ones. He said that wrongdoing, even if it brings no danger to those committing it, it brings danger to everyone. In old age, when many shameful things already attend it, he thought one should not add to them the shame that comes from wickedness. He believed that the angry man differs from the madman only in the length of time. "Those who use good fortune with fairness and moderation are least envied," he said, "for people envy not us but those around us." He said that those who are earnest about ridiculous things will become ridiculous when it comes to serious ones. He said that fine deeds ought to be followed up with more fine deeds, lest they lose their luster. He used to rebuke citizens who always elected the same men to office. "You will seem," he said, "either to think the office not worth much, or to think that not many men are worthy of it." Of a man who had sold his estates by the sea, he pretended to admire him as stronger than the sea itself. What the sea can barely flood, this man has swallowed with ease. When he was campaigning for the censorship and saw the other candidates courting and flattering the masses, he himself cried out that the people needed a harsh physician and a great purge, and that they ought to choose not the most agreeable man but the most inexorable one. And by saying this, he was elected before all the others. Teaching young men to fight with courage, he often said that the word turns more on the sword and the voice than on the hand, and that it is this that terrifies the enemy. When at war with the peoples living around the river Beetes, he found himself in danger from the sheer number of the enemy, and the Celtiberians were willing to help for 200 talents, while the Romans would not consent to promise pay to barbarians. He said they were mistaken, for if victorious, they would repay it not from their own funds but from the enemy's. And if defeated, there would be neither anyone left to demand it nor anyone left to pay it. Though he took more cities, as he himself says, than the number of days he spent among the enemy, he himself took nothing more from enemy territory than what he ate and drank. Having distributed a pound of silver to each of the soldiers, he said it was better that many return from the campaign with silver than that a few return with gold. For commanders in the provinces ought to seek nothing but the growth of their own reputation. He kept 5 servants on campaign. One of them, who had bought 3 captives without Cato's knowledge, hanged himself before coming into his sight. Once it became clear, he could not escape detection. When urged by Scipio Africanus to help the Achaean exiles return to their homeland, he pretended to have no concern for the matter. But when, after much discussion in the Senate, he rose and said, "As if we had nothing else to do, we sit here debating about some little old Greek men, whether they are to be carried out by our undertakers or by theirs." When Postumius Albinus, having written a history in Greek, asked his readers' indulgence, Cato said ironically that indulgence ought indeed to be granted if he had written it under compulsion, having been ordered to do so by a vote of the Amphictyons. They say that Scipio the Younger, in the 54 years he lived, bought nothing, sold nothing, and built nothing, and left, out of a great estate, only 33 pounds of silver and 2 of gold, and this though he was master of Carthage and had enriched his soldiers more than any other general. Keeping faithfully to Polybius's precept, he made it a rule never to leave the marketplace before he had made some acquaintance and friend, in one way or another, among those he met. Even while still young, he had such a reputation for courage and good sense that Cato the Elder, when asked about the men campaigning at Carthage, among whom Scipio also served, said, "He alone has understanding. The rest flit about like shadows." When he returned to Rome from the campaign, people called on him not out of favor to him, but because they expected that through him they would take Carthage quickly and easily. And indeed, once he had made his way onto the wall while the Carthaginians defended it from the citadel, and Polybius advised him to scatter iron caltrops or throw down spiked planks across the middle of the ditch, which was not very deep, so that the enemy could not cross and attack the earthworks, he said it was absurd, now that they had taken the walls and were inside the city, to be arranging things so as not to fight the enemy. Finding the city full of Greek statues and dedications carried off from Sicily, he had it proclaimed that people from those cities should come and identify and reclaim their property. Of the plunder, he allowed neither slave nor freedman to take anything, nor even to buy anything, though everyone else was carrying off and taking whatever they pleased. When he was helping his dearest friend Gaius Laelius in his campaign for the consulship, he asked Pompeius whether he too intended to stand for the consulship. This Pompeius was thought to be the son of a flute player. When the man said he did not intend to stand, but promised also to accompany Laelius and canvass together with him, they trusted him and waited for him, and were deceived, for word came that he was going about the marketplace greeting the citizens on his own behalf. When the others grew indignant, Scipio laughed and said, "What fools we are, as if we were about to summon not men but gods, to have wasted so much time waiting for a flute player." When Appius Claudius, contending with him for the censorship, said that he himself greeted all the Romans by name while Scipio scarcely knew any of them, Scipio replied, "You speak the truth, for my concern has been not to know many, but to be unknown to no one." He urged the citizens, since they happened to be at war with the Celtiberians, whenever they sent out both legates and tribunes on campaign, to take as witnesses and judges of each man's valor the very men who were fighting the war. When appointed censor, he took the horse away from a young man who, at a time when Carthage was under siege, had given an extravagant dinner at which he molded a honey cake into the shape of the city, called it Carthage, and set it out for the guests to plunder. When the young man asked why his horse had been taken from him, Scipio said, "Because you plundered Carthage before I did." Seeing Gaius Licinius pass by, he said, "I know this man has committed perjury, but since no one is accusing him, I cannot be both his accuser and his judge." Having been sent out a third time by the Senate, as Clitomachus says, to observe the insolence and the good order of men, an overseer of cities, nations, and kings. When he came to Alexandria and disembarked, walking with his cloak drawn over his head, the Alexandrians ran about begging him to uncover his face and show it to them, since they longed to see it. And when he uncovered it, they raised a shout and clapped their hands. As the king could barely keep pace with them while they walked, being slowed by idleness and soft living, Scipio quietly whispered to Panaetius, "The Alexandrians have already gained something from our visit here. Because of us, they have seen their king walking on foot." His traveling companions were a single philosopher friend, Panaetius, and five servants. And when one of these died abroad, since he did not wish to buy another, he sent for a replacement from Rome. Since the Numantines were thought to be unconquerable and had defeated many generals, the people appointed Scipio consul a second time for the war against them. Although many were eager to join the campaign, the Senate prevented this too, fearing that Italy would be left empty. They also would not allow him to take money that was readily available, but assigned him the tax revenues instead, which had not yet come due. Scipio said he had no need of money, for his own resources and those of his friends would suffice. But he did complain about the soldiers, for it was a hard war to fight hard, because if they had been beaten so many times by the courage of the enemy, it meant they were fighting worthy foes, but if by the cowardice of the citizens, it meant they were fighting alongside unworthy men. When he came to the camp and found much disorder, licentiousness, superstition, and luxury, he at once drove out the diviners, the sacrificers, and the brothel keepers, and ordered all equipment sent away except a pot, a spit, and an earthenware cup. He allowed those who wished to keep a silver drinking cup, but no heavier than 2 pounds. He forbade bathing, and ordered that those who anointed themselves rub each other down, since pack animals, lacking hands, needed someone else to rub them down. He ordered them to take their midday meal standing, with food requiring no fire, and to dine lying down on bread or simple porridge and roasted or boiled meat. He himself went about wrapped in a plain black cloak, saying he was mourning the army's disgrace. Taking pack animals from a tribune named Memmius that were carrying jeweled wine coolers and cups of the Riclean ware, he said, "For me you are useful for 30 days, and for your country. But for yourself, being such a man for your whole life, you have made yourself useless." When another showed off a finely adorned shield, he said, "The shield is handsome, young man, but it is more fitting for a Roman to place his hopes in his right hand than in his left." When one soldier, after raising the rampart, complained that he was terribly worn out, he said, "Naturally, you trust in that piece of wood more than in your sword." Seeing the recklessness of the enemy, he said he was buying safety with time, for a good general, like a good physician, ought to resort to the cure by iron only as a last necessity. Nevertheless, attacking the Numantines at the right moment, he put them to flight. When the older men reproached the defeated soldiers, asking why they had fled from men they had so often pursued, one of the Numantines is said to have replied that the sheep were the same as before, but the shepherd was different. After he had taken Numantia and celebrated a second triumph, he came into conflict with Gaius Gracchus on behalf of the Senate and the allies, and when the people, aggrieved, raised an uproar against him from the rostrum, he said, "The clamor of armies never troubled me, certainly not that of a rabble of men, whom I know Italy to be not a mother but a stepmother." When Gaius's followers shouted for the tyrant to be killed, he said, "Naturally, those who make war on their country want to destroy me first, for it cannot be that Rome should fall while Scipio stands, nor that Scipio should live while Rome has fallen." Caecilius Metellus, deliberating whether to advance against a fortified position, was told by a centurion that if he lost only 10 men, he would take the place. He asked the man whether he himself would like to be one of the 10. When one of the younger tribunes asked what he intended to do, he said, "If I thought my own tunic knew this plan of mine, I would take it off and burn it in the fire." Though he had been at war with Scipio while the latter lived, he grieved at his death, ordered his own sons to take up the bier and carry it, and said he owed thanks to the gods on Rome's behalf that Scipio had not been born among any other people. Gaius Marius, advancing into public life from an undistinguished family by way of military service, ran for the higher aedileship, and perceiving on the very day of the election that he was losing, he switched to the lower office. Having failed at that too, he still did not give up hope of becoming first among the Romans. Having varicose veins in both legs, he offered them to the surgeon to be cut without being bound, and endured the operation without a groan or so much as a frown. But when the doctor moved to the other leg, he would not allow it, saying the cure was not worth the pain. When his nephew Lucius, during Marius's second consulship, tried to force himself on one of the young men serving in the army, named Trebonius, and Trebonius killed him, and many brought charges against Trebonius for it, he did not deny killing the officer, but stated and proved his reason. Whereupon Marius ordered the crown given for valor to be brought, and placed it on Trebonius. Encamped opposite the Teutons in a place with little water, when his soldiers said they were thirsty, he pointed to a river flowing near the enemy's camp and said, "There is drink for you, to be bought with blood." They called on him to lead them there at once, while their blood was still liquid and not yet all dried up by thirst. In the wars against the Cimbri, he made 1,000 brave men of Camerinum into Romans on the spot, contrary to any law. And to those who objected, he said that amid the clash of arms, he could not hear the laws. In the civil war, surrounded by a trench and besieged, he held out, waiting for his own moment. When Pompedius Silo said to him, "If you are a great general, Marius, come down and fight it out," he replied, "No, if you are a great general, force me to fight it out even against my will." Catulus Lutatius, encamped by the river Atizo in the Cimbrian War, when the Romans, seeing the barbarians attempting to cross, began to retreat, and he was unable to hold them back, rushed in among the foremost of those running away, so that it might appear they were not fleeing the enemy but following their general. Sulla, hailed as the fortunate, counted two things among his greatest strokes of fortune: his friendship with Metellus Pius and his not razing Athens but sparing the city. Gaius Papilius was sent to Antiochus, bearing a letter from the Senate, ordering him to withdraw his army from Egypt and not seize the kingdom belonging to Ptolemy's orphaned children. As he approached through the camp, Antiochus greeted him warmly from a distance, but Papilius, without returning the greeting, handed over the document. And when, after reading it, Antiochus said he would deliberate and give his answer, Papilius drew a circle around him with his staff and said, "Deliberate and answer right there where you stand." Everyone was struck by the man's resolve, and when Antiochus agreed to do what the Romans wished, only then did Papilius greet him and embrace him. Lucullus in Armenia, with 10,000 infantry and 1,000 cavalry, advanced against Tigranes, who had 150,000 troops, on the day before the Nones of October, the day on which, long before, the army under Caepio had been destroyed by the Cimbri. When someone said that the Romans regarded that day as ill-omened and dreaded it, he replied, "Then let us fight eagerly today, so that we may turn this day too from one of gloom and mourning into one bright and dear to the Romans." When his soldiers were especially afraid of the enemy's armored cavalry, he told them to take courage, for it would be more work to strip these men of their armor than to defeat them. Advancing up the hill first and seeing the movement of the barbarians, he cried out, "We have won, fellow soldiers." And with no one standing against them, in the pursuit, he lost only 5 Romans killed, while he killed more than 100,000 of the enemy. Gnaeus Pompeius was as much beloved by the Romans as his father had been hated. Still young, he attached himself wholly to Sulla's party, and though holding no office and not yet a senator, he raised many soldiers from Italy. When Sulla summoned him, he refused to show his forces to the commander without spoils and without having drawn blood, and did not come until he had defeated the enemy's generals in many battles. When, sent by Sulla as commander to Sicily, he learned that the soldiers on the march were turning aside to plunder and use violence, those who wandered off and roamed about carelessly he punished, but on the swords of those he sent out on missions he affixed his seal. As for the Mamertines, who had taken the opposing side, he was ready to put every one of them to death. But when Asthenius, their popular leader, said that he was acting unjustly in punishing many who were innocent for the sake of one who was guilty, namely himself, since he had persuaded his friends and compelled his enemies to take Marius's side, Pompey, astonished, said he was willing to pardon the Mamertines for having been persuaded by such a man, one who valued his country above his own life, and he released both the city and Asthenius. Crossing over into Libya against Domitius and defeating him in a great battle, when the soldiers hailed him as imperator, he said he would not accept the honor while the enemy's ramparts still stood upright. But some of them, though a heavy rain was falling, rushed out and sacked the camp. When he returned, Sulla welcomed him warmly with other honors and was the first to call him Magnus the Great. But when Pompey wished to celebrate a triumph, Sulla would not allow it, since he did not yet belong to the Senate. When Pompey remarked to those present that Sulla did not realize that more people worship the rising sun than the setting one, Sulla cried out, "Let him triumph." Servilius, a man of aristocratic temper, was indignant at this, and many of the soldiers pressed hard for the triumph, demanding certain gifts. When Pompey said he would rather give up the triumph than flatter them, Servilius said that now he truly saw a man who was great and worthy of a triumph. Now it was the custom at Rome that when knights had served their legal term of duty, they would lead their horse into the forum before the two men called censors, and after listing their campaigns and the generals under whom they had served, they would receive the praise or blame they deserved. When Pompey was consul, he himself led his horse down to the censors Gellius and Lentulus. And when they, following custom, asked whether he had served all his campaigns, he said all of them, under myself as imperator. When he got hold of Sertorius's letters in Spain, which contained correspondence from many leading men inviting Sertorius to Rome for the sake of revolution and a change of government, he burned them all, thereby giving the wicked a chance to repent and become better men. When Phraates, king of the Parthians, sent to him demanding that the Euphrates be used as the boundary, he said that the Romans would use the boundary that justice required against the Parthians. When Lucius Lucullus, after his campaigns, gave himself over to pleasure and lived extravagantly, and criticized Pompey for craving so much activity beyond his years, Pompey said that indulgence was less fitting for an old man than the exercise of command was unfitting for one below the proper age. Once, when he was ill, his physician ordered him to take a thrush to eat, but his attendants, searching, could not find one, for it was out of season. Someone said that thrushes could be found the year round at Lucullus's estate. "Well then," he said, "if Lucullus were not so extravagant, would Pompey not have lived?" And dismissing the doctor, he took some ordinary food that was readily available. When a severe grain shortage struck Rome, he was appointed, nominally, overseer of the grain market, but in fact master of land and sea, and he sailed to Libya, Sardinia, and Sicily. And having gathered a great quantity of grain, he hastened to bring it to Rome. When a great storm arose and the ship captains hesitated, he was the first to board and, ordering the anchor raised, cried out, "To sail is necessary. To live is not necessary." When the quarrel with Caesar was coming into the open, and a certain Marcellinus, one of the men thought to have been advanced by Pompey, had gone over to Caesar's side and made many attacks on him in the Senate, Pompey said, "Are you not ashamed, Marcellinus, to abuse me, when it is through me that you have gone from being speechless to being eloquent, and from being starved to being sick from overeating?" To Cato, who had bitterly attacked him because, though Cato had often warned in advance that Caesar's power and growth were not for the good of the Republic, Pompey himself had worked against him, he replied, "Your words are more prophetic, but mine were more the acts of a friend." Speaking frankly about himself, he said that he had obtained every office sooner than he had expected, and had laid each one down sooner than had been expected. After the battle at Pharsalus, fleeing to Egypt, as he was about to cross from the trireme to the fishing boat sent by the king, he turned to his wife and son and said nothing else but the line of Sophocles, "Whoever goes as a suitor to a tyrant's court is that man's slave, even though he arrives a free man." Then, changing boats and being struck with a sword, he groaned once, said nothing further, but covered his face and gave himself up. Cicero, the orator, mocked over his name, was urged by his friends to change it, but he said he would make the name of Cicero more famous than those of the Catos, the Catuli, and the Scauri. When he dedicated a silver cup to the gods, he inscribed the first letters of his other names, but in place of Cicero, he engraved a chickpea, Cicer. Of orators who shouted loudly, he said that from weakness they resorted to shouting, like lame men mounting a horse. When Verres's son, who had made poor use of his good looks, abused Cicero for effeminacy and called him a pervert, Cicero said, "Do you not know that it is proper for children to be abused only within doors?" When Metellus Nepos said to him that, "You have put more men to death as a witness than you have saved as an advocate," he replied, "Yes, for I have more good faith than eloquence." When Metellus asked who his father was, he said, "Your mother has made that question harder for you to answer than for me, for Metellus's mother was unchaste, and Metellus himself was rather flighty and unsteady, carried about by his impulses." When his teacher of rhetoric, Diodotus, died, and someone set up a stone raven over his grave, Cicero said this was a fitting recompense, for he taught this bird to fly, not to speak. Having heard that Vatinius, a man at odds with him and generally worthless, had died, and then learning afterward that he was alive, he said, "May the liar come to a bad end, badly." To a man who was thought to be of Libyan descent, who claimed he could not hear what Cicero was saying, he said, "And yet your ear is not unpierced." When Castus Papilius, who wished to be thought a legal expert but was in fact ignorant and untalented, was summoned by Cicero as a witness in a certain case, and said he knew nothing, Cicero said, "Perhaps you think you are being asked about points of law." When Hortensius the orator had taken a silver sphinx as payment from Verres, and when Cicero made some oblique remark to him, said he was inexperienced in solving riddles, Cicero said, "And yet the sphinx is right there with you." Meeting Voconius, who had three extremely ugly daughters, he quietly remarked to his friends, "He sowed children though Phoebus forbade it." When Faustus, the son of Sulla, because of the great number of his debts, posted a notice of sale of his property, Cicero said, "I welcome this proscription of his more than his father's." When Pompey and Caesar had come to a parting of ways, he said, "I know whom I am fleeing, though I do not know whom I am fleeing to." And he blamed Pompey for abandoning the city and for imitating Themistocles rather than Pericles, though the circumstances resembled the latter's, not the former's. When he went over to Pompey and then again had second thoughts, and was asked by Pompey where he had left his son-in-law Paizo, he said, "With your own father-in-law." When someone changed sides from Caesar to Pompey and said he had left his horse behind in his haste and eagerness, Cicero said that the man had made a better decision about the horse than about himself. To one who reported that Caesar's friends were gloomy, he said, "You mean they are ill-disposed toward Caesar." After the battle at Pharsalus, when Pompey had fled and a certain Annius said that they still had seven eagles among them and urged confidence for that reason, Cicero said, "Your advice would be good if we were fighting jackdaws." When Caesar, after his victory, restored with honor the statues of Pompey that had been thrown down, Cicero remarked of him that, by setting up Pompey's statues, Caesar is fixing his own in place. So highly did he value the art of speaking well, and so eagerly did he strive for it, that once, when a case was pending before the court of the 100 men, and the day was close at hand, he freed his household slave Eros because he had told him the trial had been postponed to the following day. Gaius Caesar, when he was still a young man fleeing from Sulla, fell in with pirates. And first, when they demanded a certain sum of money, he laughed at the robbers for not knowing whom they held and promised to pay twice as much. Then, while under guard while the ransom was being collected, he ordered them to keep quiet and be still while he slept. He also composed speeches and poems and read them aloud to the pirates, and called those who did not praise them enough uncultured barbarians, and jokingly threatened to hang them, which, not long after, he actually did. For once the ransom had arrived and he was set free, he gathered men and ships from Asia, seized the pirates, and had them crucified. At Rome, when he entered a contest against Catulus, who held first rank among the Romans, for the office of Pontifex Maximus, and his mother escorted him to the door, he said, "Today, mother, you will have your son either as Pontifex Maximus or as an exile." Having divorced his wife Pompeia because of the scandal with Clodius, when Clodius was later put on trial over the same affair and Caesar was summoned as a witness, He said nothing unfavorable about his wife. And when the prosecutor asked, "Why then did you divorce her?" he said, "Because Caesar's wife must be free of even the suspicion of scandal." Reading of the exploits of Alexander, he wept and said to his friends, "At my age he had already conquered Darius, but I have accomplished nothing yet." Passing through a poor little town in the Alps when his friends wondered, half in jest, whether there too there were factions and rivalries for the first place, he stopped, grew thoughtful, and said, "I would rather be first here than second in Rome." Of bold undertakings, he said that great and risky ones ought to be carried out, not merely deliberated about. And he crossed the river Rubicon from his Gallic province against Pompey, saying, "Let the die be cast." When Pompey fled toward the sea from Rome, and Metellus, who was in charge of the treasury, tried to prevent Caesar from taking money and shut the treasury, Caesar threatened to kill him. And when Metellus was terrified, he said, "This, young man, was harder for me to say than it would be to do." When his soldiers were slow in crossing from Brundisium to Dyrrhachium, he slipped away from everyone, boarded a small boat, and tried to cross the sea alone. And when the boat was being swamped by the waves, he revealed himself to the helmsman and cried out, "Trust to fortune, and know that you carry Caesar." On that occasion, he was prevented from crossing, since the storm grew violent and his soldiers ran to him in great distress, fearing that he was waiting for another army because he distrusted them. When a battle was fought and Pompey, though victorious, did not follow up his advantage but withdrew into his camp, Caesar said, "Today the victory belonged to the enemy, but they have no one who knows how to win it." At Pharsalus, when Pompey had ordered his line of battle to stand its ground and await the enemy's charge, Caesar said he had made a mistake in relaxing the intensity and momentum his soldiers had gained from their headlong, inspired charge. Having defeated Pharnaces of Pontus at the first assault, he wrote to his friends, "I came, I saw, I conquered." After the rout in Libya of Scipio's forces and Cato's death by his own hand, he said, "Cato, I begrudge you your death, for you too begrudge me the saving of your life." When some, suspicious of Antony and Dolabella, urged him to be on his guard, he said he did not fear those fat and long-haired men, but rather those thin, pale ones, pointing to Brutus and Cassius. When a conversation arose at dinner about what kind of death was best, he said, "The unexpected one." Caesar, the first to be called Augustus, while still a young man, demanded from Antony 25 million drachmas out of the estate of the elder Caesar, after his murder, from the property which Antony had transferred to his own house, wishing to give back to the Romans what Caesar had bequeathed to them, 75 drachmas to each citizen. But when Antony kept the money and told him to forget about demanding it, if he were wise, he put his own inheritance up for public auction and sold it. And by paying out the gift, he won for himself the goodwill, and for Antony the hatred, of the citizens. When Romatalces, king of the Thracians, who had gone over from Antony to his side, behaved without restraint at drinking parties and was offensively insistent in reminding him of their alliance, Caesar, drinking a toast to one of the other kings, said, "I love treachery, but I do not praise traitors." When the people of Alexandria, after the city's capture, expected to suffer the worst, he went up onto the platform and, bringing forward Arius the Alexandrian, said he would spare the city, first because of its size and beauty, second because of its founder Alexander, and third for the sake of his friend Arius. Hearing that Eros, the administrator of affairs in Egypt, had bought a quail that was undefeated and the champion of all fighting quails, and had roasted and eaten it, he sent for him and questioned him. And when the man confessed, he ordered him nailed to a ship's mast. In Sicily, he appointed Arius as administrator in place of Theodorus. And when someone handed him a note on which was written, "Theodorus of Tarsus is bald or a thief. What do you think?" Caesar read it and wrote underneath, "I think so." From Maecenas, his companion in life, he received each year on his birthday the gift of a cup. When Athenodorus the philosopher asked, because of his old age, to be allowed to go home, he granted the request. But when Athenodorus, embracing him in farewell, said, "Caesar, whenever you are angry, say and do nothing until you have gone through the 24 letters of the alphabet to yourself," Caesar took hold of his hand and said, "I still have need of you present," and kept him for a whole year, saying, "There is a safe reward even for silence." Hearing that Alexander, at 32 years old, having conquered most of the world, was at a loss as to what he should do with the rest of his life. He wondered that Alexander did not consider it a greater task to set in order what he already possessed than to acquire his empire in the first place. Having written the law concerning adulterers, in which it is determined how those accused should be tried and how those convicted should be punished, he then, carried away by anger, struck with his own hands a young man who was accused in connection with his daughter Julia. And when the young man cried out, "You made the law, Caesar," he was so filled with remorse that he refrained from acting on that impulse that day. So that he excused himself from that day's dinner. When he sent Gaius, his grandson, to Armenia, he prayed to the gods that Pompey's goodwill, Alexander's daring, and his own fortune might attend him. He used to say he would leave the Romans as successor to the empire a man who had never twice deliberated about the same matter, meaning Tiberius. Wishing to quiet the young men of rank who were making a disturbance, when they paid no heed but kept on making noise, he said, "Listen, young men, to an old man to whom old men listened when he was young." When the Athenian people seemed to have committed some offense, he wrote from Aegina that he supposed they were not unaware that he was angry, for otherwise he would not be wintering in Aegina. But beyond this, he neither said nor did anything else to them. One of the accusers of Eurycles spoke with unsparing and excessive frankness, and was carried so far as to say something like this: "If these things do not seem serious to you, Caesar, order him to give me back the 7th book of Thucydides." At this, Augustus grew angry and ordered the man led away. But on learning that he was the last surviving descendant of Brasidas, he sent for him, and after a mild rebuke let him go. When Piso was carefully building his house from the foundations up to the very roof, Augustus said, "You make me cheerful, building like this, as though Rome were going to last forever."